your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Along with me this evening is Tony Godling from Bristol, England. Welcome, Tony.
Hi, George.
I tell you what.
There's been a bit of a joke on the streets here, I ought to relate to you. Last night, when there was Trump was deciding that he had to reissue this Muslim country's travel ban.
Yes.
Rewrite the executive order. The joke on the streets here was, I don't know what it's like in Austin, but was the that he missed out the Saudis and the Israelis for the add them in.
Right, right. There'd been criticism even from conservative circles here that the Saudis were not included in there, you know. And they were on the big list of, you know, 9/11, you know.
That's right, of course. And, of course, the Israelis are implicated in 9/11 too. I think it's mainly these dual U.S.-Israeli citizens who appear on the list, people like Doc Zakheim and people like this, who were involved in the, I suppose, what you'd call the cover-up. So that is to say, making sure that there was no proper investigation, a bit like, you know, the FBI with JFK assassination, that sort of operation that happens afterwards to make sure that, you know, the truth doesn't actually come out, doesn't get properly investigated. There's also, on that particular subject, a really good article on WikiSpooks, which is run by Robin Upton, and that's from various other people who've done a very good job of, you know, sort of doing a proper version of Wikipedia, because everything to do with the secret services on Wikipedia and big business, big pharma and people like that is basically owned and controlled. Wikipedia have got no, you know, interest in making sure that the facts are balanced at all. And so WikiSpooks has done a really good job, I think. I mean, you know, I don't know if you use the site much, but on looking at the history of the Secret Services, various operations the Secret Services have been doing over the years, its specific characters in the Secret Services, and making sure that there is a really good, robust, you know, proper people's history of the Secret Services there. But WikiSpooks have got an article called 9/11 Israel Did It. Now, it's, you know, I don't necessarily agree with that headline that the Israelis did 9/11, but there is certainly a lot of evidence they present there, and it's all fully referenced to specific individuals' motives, means, opportunities of these dual U.S.-Israeli citizens mostly. And, of course, the motivation really is simple. They want the U.S. To be able to intervene anywhere they want in the world, and this provides an opportunity for doing that sort of thing, as we've seen since 9/11 in the Middle East.
Right. You know, there's this Elliot Abrams is being broached as associate director of undersecretary for the Secretary of State here. And, boy, that's raising a hullabaloo, I'll tell you that.
Well, look, the settlement program's appalling. I mean, if you want to look at the whole situation with Israel, I noticed as well just the other day, Jacob Rothschild was interviewed in the Times of Israel, confessing, really, his family's key role in the Balfour Declaration 100 years ago, which was first published, I believe, in 1917, so 100 years ago this year,
okay,
which led to the creation of the State of Israel. But that was, I mean, you know, in the situation, of course, this is in the middle of the First World War, and anyone that does their historical research on this will see that by 1916, the First World War had pretty much come to an end. and the British weren't going to get anywhere into, you know, fighting with Germany. The Germans hadn't given up any ceded any territory at all in that war. Effectively, the German borders were intact. Germany was defending itself very robustly, and so there was an offer of peace from the Germans to the British, saying, "Look, let's just go back to the old borders and forget this silly war." After the millions that had been killed already, they were saying, "Look, anyway." At that point, the Zionists in the United States, the people that wanted the Brits to sign the Balfour Declaration, came forward saying, "Look, if you go along with this Balfour Declaration," what we're hearing now, of course, from Jacob Rothschild, really should be called the Rothschild Declaration, then we will bring the US into the First World War on your side. And that is one of the reasons why, first of all, the First World War dragged on for as long as it did, and secondly, why we ended up with this crazy idea of the State of Israel being created in the first place. You know, we've seen this here in Britain, obviously in the US you have too. The idea of plantations, that is when you bring vast amounts of population, plonk them in the middle of somewhere where there's already an existing population, it just creates massive amounts of rancor. We've seen it in Northern Ireland. You know, we're pushing the Irish Catholics out of all of the good land in the north of Ireland, the good agricultural land, telling them to go and basically live on the, this is back in the, the 17 and 1800s, live on the, hills, on the rocks, effectively.
Yeah, the rocky land.
That's
on
like
the
rock, place where you can't grow anything. You know, you might be able to keep a few goats, or a few sheep. Nothing's going to grow
there.
They
call them rock goats, right?
So that was the history in Ireland as well. And of course, that was what was started off with this whole Balfour Declaration, and I just thought it was absolutely gobsmacking to see Jacob Rothschild there saying, "Well, yeah, it was our family that were behind it."
Oh man, I mean, it goes on and on. These people are just the money and they're just out of their minds. I mean, there's a craziness out there today, you know?
Yeah, there is, and I think it's really born of a kind of hawkish spirit. Now, that, I think, is typified by something we saw in Cambridge last week, which was one of these toffs, public school boys who got into Cambridge University, burning a £20 note in front of some homeless people on one particular.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. Man.
And they do this just to sort of take the mickey, like, "This means nothing to me." Of course, it can probably see you through a couple of weeks of getting little bits of food and this kind of thing. And
exactly. Yeah, those homeless could live on that for a week or two.
But the trouble is, we've got a really seriously cruel elite in this country where people like the Bullingdon Club in Oxford, which of course David Cameron was a member of, Boris Johnson a member of, George Osborne a member of. I mean, the list goes on and on. People who are major figures in the newspapers, in the Financial Times, leader writer is one of them. These people see themselves as kind of, they're going to elite. But the way they get tapped up into these clubs is interesting, George. That's that incident with the guy that's burning the £20 note in front of a homeless man, that is the sort of thing he could, he could find the next semester. He's tapped up to join Cambridge. In the Cambridge, it's the Pitt Club. There's in Oxford, it's the Bullingdon Club. I mean, there are various other.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
I mean, obviously in Yale, you've got the Skull and Bones over there.
Yeah. And the Scroll and Pen or whatever is another one of them, I think.
But these elite they tap these people up. Number one, if they're from very powerful, rich families. They know that they're kind of ruthless people who will do anything for, to sort of gain more for themselves. And I think that's one of the problems we've got in the Western world particularly. I mean, I don't know really what goes on in China, etc., but certainly it's going on here, is these hawkish characters who are prepared to sell the rest of humanity down the river for their own self-aggrandizement. These are the ones that are picked up at an early age and groomed for power and then placed into some of these most important positions in banking, etc., in the land.
Right, those Rhodes scholarships are right there in the middle of it.
Well, yes, yeah, you've got that, and you've got the Yale fellowships too. You know,
right? You got the Skull and Bones over there.
Well, we got Yale fellowships. Yeah. What happens with those is that these are people mostly from Britain, but I mean, other parts of the world as well, of course. But you know, a lot of Brits get tapped up as Yale scholars, taken over and educated at Harvard and Yale, places like that.
Right, in the Ivy League schools. Yeah.
What they say to these young men and women is, we think you are the leaders of tomorrow. Well, actually, what they're doing is they're just kind of grooming them. They keep
an
eye on them so that they've got lots of background information and profiling on them, so that they will do what they're told, basically. And then they start feeding them with all this gobbledygook, like Bill Clinton came out with, you know, which is just, you know, he will say the right things, but he's got no intention of actually doing anything useful much. And those are the people we see jettisoned or elevated up into power in future years.
You know, this Parag Khanna, you know him? He's pushing technocracy. He wants to reform the whole United States political system. And he's been groomed just like you're describing there by all the top CFR and all that stuff, you know?
Yeah, the CFR, of course, play a massive role. I think they're a really important organization. Not a lot of people seem to really understand that. You know, there's very little of them pop up on our TV screens. We seem to get a load of puppets, basically, appearing on television. And the real people who are controlling things behind the scenes, I mean, talking about the bankers, you know, the senior judges that make important court decisions, the chief executives of the big multinationals, they are very, very wary of appearing. In fact, it's funny, you go back to the 1970s and 80s here in the UK, and I've spoken to a lot of journalists, public relations people, etc., and they say, well, back in those days, these people were only too pleased to go on TV because they were running organisations which they were actually proud of. Nowadays, they're up to so much skullduggery, what with the big corporations modelling themselves on the narco cartels, as Roberto Saviano reminds us, you know, the guy who was in the drug cartels, the Italian, who's now 24/7 protection from two Carabinieri, you know, making sure that no one assassinates him for spilling the beans on the mob in Italy.
God.
I mean, he's basically saying, look, now the narco cartel is the model for Western capitalism. The biggest companies, the most powerful companies, the ones that grow the fastest, are all modelling themselves and a successful model of the narco traffickers.
Oh man, it's getting so wild out there.
But there's no law really for the super rich. There's no you know, they're basically above the law. They're looking at the situations where when they do break the law, and of course they do this regularly. The criminal elite do this. They know that their status as an executive or a director of a big company will protect them. So it will be the company that gets sued, not them. And when the company gets sued, well, they've got a whole army of lawyers, first of all, that can try and make sure that they win that case as a company. But secondly, when the fines come along, even if they lose, the fines are absolutely paltry sums compared to the massive profits that companies can make by behaving in a criminal manner. So, you know, you can see what the motive is here. It's just pure profit, and the law is not actually punishing companies. I mean, of course, what they should be doing is, for example, taking away banking licenses, saying for HSBC, for example, right, as of tomorrow, you're not allowed to operate as a bank. You know, that would certainly focus the minds of the directors and executives, but at the moment, they know that's not going to happen.
Right. I've had a recent interview with Roger Stone, interviewing him on his book, The Making of the President, 2016. He's a very interesting person. And he had a lot to say. He's really a good friend with Trump. For 40 years, they've known each other.
Yeah, but Trump is finding out pretty quick, George, isn't he, that he can't just do what he wants.
Exactly. That's a good point, Tony. Running a corporation and running the United States is, you know, the president, two different things.
Yeah, well, he's saying is this is what we're going to do. And then he's finding out the next few days he can't do it. He can't do it. So in a way, he's in a kind of straitjacket. The deep state is running the show.
Exactly.
He's coming up across the deep state quite a lot. I think the guy, you know, has got reasonably honorable intentions, right?
I think he does. He has, deep down, I think he cares about America.
Which is different really to Hillary Clinton. I think she was really, you know, definitely a charlatan. But the thing with, right, with Trump is that he is prepared to change his mind, change his views, it seems, quite regularly. And, I mean, for example, we heard him railing against NATO, and then suddenly he's all for it, you know. So it's very difficult when there's somebody who's seems to sort of change their mind with the wind, you know, that is difficult. But, you know, he will find that actually the position of President of the United States is largely a PR job, you know. So you're going on TV, you're talking about this and that, but other people are deciding what happens.
Well, you know, on this immigration thing, he did not organize that well enough before he signed that executive order.
But that
order,
is kind of normal. Know? That's kind of normal, yeah, because it's a brand new administration. He's got a whole new load of advisors, new lawyers, people have not necessarily any experience working in government.
Yeah, right, exactly.
The corporate sector. So they're drafting, you know, I know what it's like having drafted motions for our trade union, the Journalists Union, for example. The first time you do it, you send it in and they say, sorry, that's not worded right, you know. So it comes back and you have to try again. Now, you know, having been done it for a few years, I can, you know, write a motion pretty well. But this is exactly the sort of situation these lawyers have been in, is that they are now trying to draft stuff that they haven't actually had a lot of experience. Of course, the other thing is the Supreme Court in the US, and many of the courts are stuffed with people appointed by Obama and by previous administrations.
Right, that Ninth Circuit, see, out of Northwest there is very liberal.
The courts, really. I mean, I think, you know.
But they've had a lot of their decision turned back from the Supreme Court or turned down or ruled again.
A lot of the decisions of the courts.
Yeah.
Immediately post-war, I think we had some reasonably good justice systems. But, you know, since the 1970s, 1980s, it's really gone downhill badly. And you've got a very politicized court system where the judges are selected because they will do the right thing. I mean, I'm not saying necessarily they're Freemasons or, you know, part of some formal secret society. But, you know, that, of course, that might be the case. But they are the sorts of people who will do what they're told. And that's why they're selected and they're promoted up through the judicial system.
Exactly.
It's because they don't have minds of their own. I mean, you've got the most obvious example anywhere in the world, pretty much, is in places like Egypt, where you've got a whole judicial system. Now, as soon as President Morsi, when he was elected after the Arab Spring to run Egypt, he said, right, look, one of the first things we're going to do is we're going to have a proper system for selecting judges who have got the respect of the whole profession, of the legal profession, and the public. They are going to be the ones that are promoted through the judicial system in Egypt, and they're going to be the ones that which we appoint to the top positions in the courts. That was when Sisi got the green light from the US and the other major powers to go in and do a coup to stop him, because that's the last thing they wanted in Egypt, is to have an independent judiciary and people who would just sort of follow law, etc. And that's what we've got in the West to a different degree, a more subtle extent. I think we've got the same kind of thing, a very politicized judiciary.
You know, Egypt, I did a paper on that a while back. And the military controls or owns about 25% to 40% of the economy. They're actually in manufacturing over there. The army is. So that's why they did away with Morsi and them, because he got in the way of the military interests. See what I mean? They own the country.
Would it be interesting
economically
if some of those military interests had been challenged in the courts, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
With independent judges, you know, they would have been running scared.
Now, the way I got onto this, I was digging down into the central bank of Egypt, and then I came across an article where the military loaned the central bank $1 billion. You know what I mean? Usually it's the other way around. You know what I mean, Tony? With all your research, the central banks are...
This happens between things like... Places like Deutsche Bank, UBS in Switzerland, do the same exact thing with the European Central Bank. And then you know what they do? The European Central Bank lends them the money back again.
Exactly.
And they start building up fictional amounts of massive billions of dollars and pounds and euros.
And credit,
exist. So this is this is what these guys, and the other thing is, of course, with their chums, they have zero interest rates as well. So we'll lend you $1 billion on zero interest, and then you can lend it back to us at zero interest, all of a sudden the bank's books look healthy, you know. So this is what the sort of crazy games they're
playing. Well, when individuals do that, they're kiting checks.
Yeah.
When banks do it, they can do what they want. You know, Dutch Bank is owed about over $300 million by Trump.
Yeah,
Trump had a big loan there.
I've had an interesting week over here, actually. I've been visited by a guy called James Dickey. He's changed his name to Jakob Zaki. He's a Scottish writer, and he's a historian on Islamic architecture in Europe. And it was great to have him visiting Bristol from London, where he lives, and took him around. I mean, he took me around various sites in the city of Bristol from the 1600s. Where Islamic architectural things like Islamic tiles, artifacts were brought up from what recently had been Muslim Spain through the merchants.
Yeah, the Moors moved in and did a lot. Yeah,
they certainly did. And great him giving me a bit of a history lesson. And
that's a nice personal tour, isn't it?
But one of the things, it was funny because I was taking him back to the bus station to get the bus back to London, George. And I started chatting with him. I thought, wow, this guy, apparently he's an expert in secret societies. And anyway, so he started waxing lyrical about the Masons in the Illuminati and various things. And it turns out we had a bit of a common interest in that. But you know what I found so fascinating? And you know, we were talking a few weeks ago, I think, about Henry Kissinger and his role as a kind of go-between China and the West. And he's been doing that for a long, long time. Now, for a long time, the Chinese communist-run China was seen to be a kind of completely separate. You know, okay, so you could visit, there were visa restrictions, this kind of thing, but there weren't very many in the way of high-level links between the two superpowers. Nowadays, of course, due to Kissinger is playing a kind of double game with the two of them. And what struck me as amazing that Jakob told me about this is that very few people realize that the Illuminati in Germany, who were certainly, there's very strong evidence that they were the people behind the French Revolution and possibly the
Jacobins,
the American Revolution too.
Jacobin
clubs. The ideas of Rousseau and people like this played a big part, but the secret societies basically planning events from behind the scenes that then appeared just to happen, you know, as a revolution. And of course, you know, you have to be, your bankers play an important part in all this because they set up the economic turmoil, which then the people demand a kind of answer to eventually. But anyway, what he was saying was that the whole evolution of the triads in China mirrors in time, you know, the same period exactly as the emergence of the Illuminati in Europe, which I found quite fascinating. You know, certainly a fascinating character, I think, George. And this, is, to me, was like quite a big penny dropping here, saying, well, hang on, maybe this stuff has been going on in parallel over the centuries. It's not just something which, you know, was happening in Europe with Weishaupt and the bringing under... I mean, the key thing to understand about the Illuminati is that the Freemasons have been going for a long, long time in Europe, even though they kind of only supposedly emerged in the early 1700s. But there was this conference in Wilhelmsbad in 1782.
Yes, I'm onto that. I've been onto that for a year now.
Which lasted a couple of weeks, where all the Masons in Europe got together, and they all agreed to sign up to being governed by this German Illuminati group. So that was a big change, because they up until then they'd all been independent. They could run their own affairs. But in a way, that was a kind of Masonic European Union, you know.
Yes, it was. Well, Rothschilds were right there, see. Okay. In fact, they were advising the Prussian prince in that area and investing for him. See what I mean? And they got their start from this wealthy prince in London. You know, because when Napoleon swept through, the prince took his money and the Rothschild took the money into London and invested it there away from the French. And then when Napoleon was pushed out, then they became to stabilize the governments again. But yeah, that 1782 is a key to seeing the dominance of the Illuminati within the Freemasonry system.
Yeah, and also, of course, worth pointing out, there are some really good books on this. There is the conspiracy, proofs of a conspiracy,
yes,
against
John Robison
and governments, yeah, of Europe by John Robison in,
and there's a French version of something like that too.
1793 that came out, and it's amazing. We're going back a long way here, aren't we?
Right.
And then it was Code of the Illuminees. By Abbé Barruel, the French one you were talking about.
That's the French friend, yeah, right.
That came out in 1798.
Barruel, yeah. Abbé Barruel, yeah.
You know,
right.
Basically, they're two studies of the same thing, and both of them written with very intimate knowledge. I mean, Robison was actually a Mason himself who could see
this
thing happening.
Yes, he was. He feared the Illuminati takeover of Freemasonry.
He was saying, look, they're destroying this organization, these people, and actually they're setting up a nightmare for the future, because these are powerful organizations. And if they're able to work together with a kind of hierarchy, it's going to be an absolute nightmare for people in the years to come. And I mean, we're seeing a similar sort of thing with the banking system, aren't we, in the US and Europe, where they're storing up this debt, which is going to destroy future generations.
Now, the DOMA were the secret group within Freemasonry in Turkey that are dominant, but the DOMA were Zionist based out of Greece, Salonika, okay? And that's an interesting thing. Freemasonry dominates from the secular viewpoint in Turkey. They've allowed Islam to flourish, but only under control of a federal organization there.
Yeah, now, also worth pointing out, I think.
Erdogan's upset this, this organization, the way they had it organized now, so he's sort of a loose cannon, see, in there. Well, that's why they tried to remove him, see.
We need a few more loose cannons, I think.
Oh, Tony, you always come up with good... You think way outside the box, Tony.
Well, I think the thing is, actually, humanity works well when the systems of government allow people to flourish in their own fields. In other words, so, you know, a good government will allow people to just get on and do their own thing and not try and control them. A bad government feels like it's got to just control everyone. Now, I'm not saying there shouldn't be a planned economy. I think there definitely should. And that governments should spend, money on infrastructure, this kind of thing, just to facilitate people flourishing in their own individual industries. But once you start getting control freaks into government, what happens is no one is allowed to do anything without their say-so. And that is just it's human nature. Some control freaks like to be in government. And then what they do is they try and get other control freaks alongside them.
It's synergistic. It builds a damn empire within the government.
I mean, you end up with this expression, cowards and control freaks in charge. So you get a mixture of both, don't you? You know, people who are just totally spineless will do anything they're told.
Neocons. It sounds like neocons you're describing.
Yeah, and then behind them, the puppeteers behind them are all complete control freaks. So I think actually Trump is doing something to try and stir that whole hornet's nest up a little bit. But whether he'll succeed, I'm afraid only time will tell, George.
Right, and he's being surrounded by these control people, right? And I don't think he doesn't quite have the insight that you and I have as far as behind the scenes.
Well, true, but then also, I think it's always a good idea for us commentators to realize we don't know in what ways he's been threatened, because generally when you're at the top level like that, you're getting the Secret Services possibly threatening, the CIA.
Exactly.
People like this saying, issuing quiet threats to you. Now, if he was to then go on and talk about those in public, then, people would maybe ridicule him. But that is the sort of thing, and I think it's that kind of threat, and particularly from the bankers. The bankers love doing this. They're saying, look, we've just got this rumor that XYZ banking system is going to collapse unless you do this. Yeah, now that is the big threat which was made to Gordon Brown back in 2008 and others, yeah? So they're saying, look, we're going to crash the whole money system on you unless you sign this piece of paper. And those are the sort of things that we won't necessarily be hearing about on the news.
Right. I see a break that has occurred with China, though, of this inside group. And it looks like to me that because of China's military buildup, I think that went against their agreement with the buildup China, business wise. But they don't want that military buildup in China. That's sort of what I'm seeing right now.
Yeah, well,
and that's why bringing some of this industry back home, and you know, the Economist magazine mirrored the same thing. See, and that's a propaganda organ of the Rothschild anyway. See what I mean?
Yeah,
so,
well,
now, those are the key things that I look at and read, and I have to look through the article, see what I mean, to see what the motive is of the article, see what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's hard to say exactly sometimes.
This stuff does go back a long way. I think, you know, we're looking at this kind of Orwellian system with the people farm, yeah? So farmers, these guys are the super elite that just either play golf or just go to their club and chit-chat whilst other people that they walk past on the road are starving. You know, they've got infinite amounts of money. They don't really have to work at all for a living. And the money just keeps coming in. Most of it actually at the moment will of course be quantitative easing money, which is only going to people who are already wealthy. People who already have a lot of property, already have a lot of share capital, they're the ones who it's all being kind of renewed and nourished with all this quantitative easing money. It's not finding its way at all really into the real economy, so into real wages, the real world, or into welfare payments, that kind of thing. They're all being cut back. So this system of quantitative easing is really it's kind of the biggest con in history, really. What they're saying is, well, we've messed the economy up, the criminal elite, the bankers, and what we're going to do is we're going to make sure we have plenty more money and our friends have plenty more money, and the poorest three-quarters of society just get poorer and poorer and poorer, and then start being the people who are paying the taxes to support us. So... But there's very few people articulating this in the opposition groups in the Western world. I have seen hardly any of it. And yet, if you look at the way the money system's operated, that seems to be their game, is that they want the poor to pay to keep them in clover, effectively. And they're succeeding. They've succeeded because of the totally ineffective mainstream London media, the Washington, you know, the mainstream press is just not explaining this, not critiquing it. Because they're part of the corporate con.
Exactly, exactly. It's rigged, like Trump was saying. But now he played it himself when he was on the outside and wasn't president. He was using these people too. See what I mean? So he knows both. You know, he's getting a taste from the other side now of trying to govern this thing. It's not easy. See?
Well, yeah, because you've got this kind of core of super rich families. I mean, I was just looking the other day, you know, going back to this
Illuminati
stuff, looking at this chap from the 1700s, the Duke of Saxe-Coburg-Altenburg. He's an ancestor of the Queen. In fact, of course, her surname is and Prince Charles and all the rest of them. Their surname isn't Windsor; it's Saxe-Coburg-Gotha. And he was the guy who was funding and supporting Adam Weishaupt and the Illuminati, you know.
Oh, man.
If we go back to the Second World War and all the stuff we've discussed several times, George, about Operation Market Garden and particularly Martin Bormann and the extraction of Bormann by the British commandos, the M section of MI6, at the end of the Second World War, which is written out by Christopher Crichton, whose real name was John Ainsworth Davis, but he wrote under that pen name because he was worried about being sued under the Official Secrets Act while he was still alive. He died a couple of years ago. But that book really explains that, effectively, this secret unit, which was personally funded by the king, it wasn't part of the Ministry of Defence funding of the army. It was an army unit at this M section MI6 run by Major Desmond Morton, who was Churchill's private secretary. But these were the guys who were going in and extracting Bormann from Berlin just from under the noses of the Russians. Now, Bormann had the keys to all the bank accounts, but again it comes back to the royal family. It was their private MI6 army unit, M section, that ran all this, you know. So these royals really, I mean, you know, they're invulnerable behind the scenes. I mean, I actually think the Queen is, you know, Queen Elizabeth's not a bad woman. I think she's probably quite a nice person. But at the end of the day, she's part of this system
Exactly.
She's also extremely super rich. You know, she's managed to, her serfs have managed to extract millions and millions of pounds from the British taxpayer to help her look after her palaces over the last few months, even though she is one of the, if not the, richest woman in the world. So,
exactly.
Taking money from the mouths of kids and hungry, unemployed, starving people in this country to rebuild her palaces when she could easily afford to do it herself. So it's not, doesn't say very much for her moral integrity.
Right, I know. Well, tell you what, Tony, thank you for being with us this evening. Boy, I tell you what, you really are insightful, more and more insightful every time we talk, you know?
Well, I hope so. I hope so, George. And I would just thoroughly recommend, if your listeners haven't already, that they check out that article on WikiSpooks about the Israeli involvement in 9/11, because it is just amazing to see so many of these key figures seem to be linked in with it. And also, just to finish, that article was posted up on Facebook a year or so ago by a London vicar, a guy called the Reverend Stephen Sizer, and he's based on the outskirts of London in southwest London, and there were all sorts of complaints because it says 9/11, Israel did it, all the proof in the world.
Right.
And I mean, like I say, I don't necessarily agree that Israel did do it, but it's certainly worth looking at an article which is showing evidence of you know, who's behind 9/11. And as a result, he was called in to see Stephen Sizer, by the way, is the author of a very good book on Zionism called The Road Map to Armageddon, which is a little bit of a poke of fun at this whole road map to peace, you know, that didn't, never really worked.
Oh, okay.
So Zionism, Road Map to Armageddon. And he was called in to see the bishop Guildford, the Bishop of Guildford, because he was in the Guildford diocese. And the Bishop of Guildford says, look, you're not allowed to speak about anything to do with the Middle East until I say so. And that was an amazing position for a vicar to be in, who stood in the pulpit under the orders from the Bishop of Guildford. He's not allowed to talk about the Middle East.
Oh, man. God.
Anyway, Stephen Sizer's well worth a read, and you can find a lot of books by him online, because, of course, this whole move to move the capital of Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem is a big part of the wider Zionist plan. In fact, it's station 4 on a 6-station trip to the full realization of the Zionist goals, which, you know, ultimately might well mean a religious war between Israel and Iran, and that's a whole other subject, but that looks as if that's the game. And that's one of the reasons the media in the West is so controlled, because when that war breaks out, God forbid it does, but when it does, the idea is that everybody will be on the side of Israel, believing that Netanyahu is some kind of God-given guy, you know, that's doing Jesus's work or something. But the Christian Zionists have completely got it around the wrong way. I think that anyone that's doing what the Israeli government are doing to the indigenous people of the area really needs to have a good look at themselves and, you know, understand what is really going on the ground and take a close look at that. So anyway, George, thanks ever so much for having me on.
Okay.
Again.
Well, thank you.
Anyone
and
that wants
night.
To follow the stuff on our website is thisweek.org.uk.
Okay. Thank you, Tony. Good night.
Cheers, George.
Bye-bye. That was Tony Gosling. Thank you again, Tony, from Bristol, England. And our conversations are usually pretty interesting. We've had just so much going on this week in this country. The turmoil that we're beginning to see by the adversaries to Trump, to the Trump administration, boy, that is building up and it's getting worrisome. Recently, there was this, you could say there were problems in Oregon, and then especially so at the University of California at Berkeley. And Milo, they wouldn't let him speak out there, and they're just raising hell all over. And then now we've got, you know, they're just ruling by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in the Washington Northwest area has come in, and they're saying, look, the president doesn't have the right to do this, but I don't think they're on good legal grounds. I think that Ninth Circuit does not have a good foundation for their ruling out there. So I don't understand. I understand what's going on. You've got this left liberal democratic coalition community that is mad as hell because Trump is going in, and they view him as an enemy, and they view him that he's against these very, very liberal ideas that they have become to rely on and have been predisposed to for the last 8 years under Obama. Now he's coming in and he's unsettling their worldview. He's working towards enforcing immigration, a very strong enforcement of that. And so they're upset about that. The Mexican community in Mexico and those that have shortly arrived from Mexico in this country are banding together and going out into the street and just demonstrating. Just, my gosh, I could not realize. Now, I'm going to interview this next hour coming up. I'm going to be interviewing Roger Stone. And this is something not to miss this second hour. So he's written a book recently, The Making of the President 2016, with a subtitle, How Donald Trump Orchestrated a Revolution. And that's written by Roger Stone. He's been in politics as a political analyst and pundit for well over 40 years. He's a personal friend with President Trump. He plays golf with him. He's worked for him on a consulting basis on political lobbying efforts and so forth. And he has a lot to say. And in this book, I've read the book. He sent me a review copy. And it's something I highly recommend to all of our listening audience to go out. The Making of the President 2016, How Donald Trump Orchestrated a Revolution, by Roger Stone. And it's fastly becoming, it's not yet, but it's fastly becoming a New York Times bestseller, and I think it's going to make it to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. He has a very insightful insights into the race and the campaigns, both of Hillary and Trump, and how it worked through that. But let's get back to this University of California at Berkeley. I ran across in my research in 2014, the free speech movement was started in 1964 on the campus of the University of California at Berkeley. And it was started by students who were denied the ability to lobby and to hand out leaflets and so forth and pamphlets that were of a political nature out in front of the student union. That there was an area out there on the sidewalk, and it's actually in Berkeley, city of Berkeley. But they maintained that they could sit out, set tables up out there and hand out political pamphlets and so forth of their candidates or whatever. But the administration at Berkeley denied them that. Well, this started a blowback of the free speech movement. Now, Sol Stern, who was a proponent and founder of the free speech movement, in 2014, they had a 50-year reunion at Berkeley of all the people that were founding members and were activists of that original free speech movement in 1964 at Berkeley. And so many of the outstanding proponents and leaders met there. Now, one individual, Sol Stern, was not a meeting there. He refused to go out there, but he instead wrote an article, okay? And I have this article up on my site. And the article, we'll have that up this evening for you to read. But in that article, and this article was written in 2014, he basically said what they started out and attained to a large degree up through the free speech movement was no longer in effect on the campus of the University of California at Berkeley. In fact, he castigated what was going on out there and slammed it and criticized it to a large degree. And he said they no longer had a free speech movement out there. They had suppression of free speech. Now, when you start reading about microaggressions and statements that are supposed to be made, trigger statements by you know, professors, and you find out that they built sort of a cocoon on campus for the students to exist within and to be secure within from outside of any criticism. But Sol Stern goes on and says that in that article, he lambastes some of the professors and the teachings because he lambastes basically this political correctness that's been going on the campuses. And I think that's why they had this against Milo out there. He was going to speak. He's the editor of Breitbart online magazine. And so to the liberal left, so to speak, he was despised and hated by them because he was against their liberal view. Now, Roger Stone in his book, The Making of the President, says that if you're, for some reason, if you go against their beliefs, the liberal left, then you're considered to be a danger to the world, see. So they have no tolerance. What's happened is this liberal left has become very intolerant and very judgmental and very hateful and so forth of anything that's on the moderate to conservative right, see. And that's the young people have been caught up in this. And the way I see it is we've got some good Americans both on the left and the right out there. But it just seems right now that when Hillary was defeated by Trump, then I think what was set into motion was a rebellion from the left. And I think it was sponsored and put together by Hillary and the left to try to disrupt and try to destroy anything that President Trump is trying to achieve. When she spoke the next day after the election, she wore a suit with purple, and the other colors that were prominent were white and green, were suffragette colors. And Roger Stone in his book makes a note of those colors. Now, we have George Soros that's funded several what they call color revolutions. And so what we might be seeing from Hillary and that far left, extreme left bunch is a color revolution. See, under the guise of Trump being a legitimate elected president because Hillary is claiming to have a majority of votes overall, but the Electoral College awarded, the way it's set up, the election to Trump, see. Now, we're seeing a period in American history that is very dangerous, and I'll tell you why it's dangerous is that the left, okay, we have to go back to the greenback that was created during the Civil War by the North. The greenback was created because they needed more specie to turn over goods and services to further and support the war interest and so forth for the North, to get everyone equipped and so forth. So Congress of that day, Abraham Lincoln's Congress, authorized the issuance of what they called the greenback. The greenback provided a means to turn over goods and services that furthered the North's war interest, okay? But that was okay during the war. And then after the war, though, the bankers declared war on the greenback and eventually, through mechanizations and manipulations and so forth, brought back the Federal Reserve in 1913. See, now, the liberal left in their schooling, and they go to economic school and all that, was never clued in on the way the Federal Reserve was set up. G. Edward Griffin wrote a book on it, The Creature of Jekyll Island, which was excellent, explaining how the Federal Reserve was first set up. But the liberal left never got clued in on the money. They're only now discovering something about credit and banking and so forth. The real knowledge about the Federal Reserve and the exposure of the way the banker set it up to rule America and to dominate America financially and so forth through the issuance of credit, okay, but on a monopolistic basis. So the bankers set up a monopoly of money creation, and that's what the liberal left was never taught. Now, the right was they came in from the right groups with this knowledge and tried to expose it. And then, of course, it overflowed the dividing line between the left and right into some of the left. But the left is not cognizant of their master and who they've been manipulated by. And let me tell you who they're manipulated by. The Fabian Society was a society set up in the late 1800s in England by the wealthy. And what they wanted to do was they wanted to bring about a socialistic society for the poor, for the lower classes. And that worked well up to only into recent times. And then the ability to produce and goods and services and to maintain this highly socialized state is failing in today's current times. But what we see is that we see that the big money has been behind the left in this country also. And the reason why they're behind the leftist and the communist and the socialist leftist is they want to create a world communist system for the lower classes. And they'll control them through the benefits and entitlement programs that would be provided to everyone that is a so-called world citizen or whatever by these strong centralized statist governments who in turn will be owned and ruled by the big money system through a electronic banking system. Now, what we've got to try to do is to say, hey, liberal left, liberal Democrats or whoever, wake up to what and who your real master has been. Study the history. Try to understand that the ultra-capitalists, okay, have actually been financing the left to bring about a world communist system, but you're not aware of that yet, see. You're battling this thing called capitalism, see, but on a broad basis. In fact, what the Marxist communist teachings in the schools and so forth have been that capitalism is the evil, see. But what they fail to explain in more detail about, say, capitalism in this country is that the Federal Reserve was a monopoly of money creation, privately owned. And then that monopoly of money creation and privately owned has been the crony or the monopolistic capitalism under which everyone has come under their control. So capitalism in general is not bad. It provides a means and methods by which to put people to work, to create jobs and companies and so forth. But it's the crony capitalism that came out of the private ownership of the Federal Reserve system that has been the real problem behind the scenes. So what we've got to do is try to explain about the money problem. The second problem that's never taught in the schools is about the secret society and the occult problems that the country has. And just recently, the Pizzagate has been uncovering some of the occult connections to the higher-ups and the higher elites. But there again, this false concept of fake news was created to cover up the pedophilia and so forth that's happening in the top elites. And back in the 80s, when we had these scandals in these child care centers in different parts of the country, I think there were some in Ohio and then California. Well, back then, these defendants of pedophile charges in court, they started relying upon false memory, okay, as a defense. And what they alleged was that these children that were quizzed and interrogated and so forth did not have reliable memories of those events. Or another subterfuge or another assertion was by these defendants was, look, you've got psychologists and psychiatrists that have examined these children and quizzed them and questioned them about these possible events that were abusive. But we don't believe that the children could reliably provide an accurate memory of that experience. So that's where the pedophiles have been. They've created this false memory syndrome idea, and they even went so far as to create a false memory foundation. And within that foundation, they started trying to establish this false memory as a legitimate defense in the trials that they were being prosecuted in. Now, The most of the evidence when it comes to false memory, if you go in and research this and really dig down in this, most of the evidence castigates and nullifies that false memory is a legitimate concept and idea. Most of your evidence is on the side of the child and in support of the young children having accurately able to remember their events and the very abusive events that they've been subjected to. There would be situations when the events were very severe and were conducted within a safe family, is where you do have some memory problems, but it would be explained by multiple personality disorder or dissociative type of a dynamic that would occur. And that's the severe cases. Your normal cases of abuse, most children, and these are authorities and experts in this field, are stating in their multiple publications and white papers that young children that have experienced the typical abuse can remember accurately those events. Now, getting back to the mindset that we have in this rebellion that has been promulgated by, you know, the liberal left Democrats who have overly made paranoid their followers. Okay, the over the decades since the 50s onward. Okay, and I would have to say about 60-65 years, we've had a deteriorating economic and social system that has been debased by a lot of ideas. Okay. The left and the right, the east and the west, you could say the communist and the capitalist systems have been at odds, okay? And many of the proponents of communism, and one in particular was Antonio Gramsci, okay? He was a founder of the Italian Communist Party, okay? He would write and campaign within the Communist Party and try to make his opinions known within the Soviet Union to those communist leaders there, that the way to defeat the West was to attack the culture of the West. So you could say that he supported what some have been called a culture war against the West, okay? In other words, you go after the institutions, the religious and political institutions, and you start attacking those and bringing them down. And what arises as a result is something way, way less than Western culture or Western thought or Western institutions. And that makes them more amenable to change, see. And so Antonio Gramsci advocated this, and at the time there was a dissension within the Communist Party in the Soviet Union. They didn't. Some agreed with Antonio Gramsci, and some didn't. And he was called to Moscow at one time, and he thought, well, maybe I'm not going to go back to Italy. But they allowed him to return to Italy at the time. But so his idea of the defeat of the West, the capitalist West, you could say at that time, was to destroy the culture of the West, and that has occurred, it appears to me. We've had a change, an attack on our very Constitution. We've had, you could say, the Constitution, and this is coming out of these so-called Ivy League colleges on the East Coast there, you know, which I don't... respect at all anymore. I think they're the worst universities to send your children to. The Yale, the Harvard and all that. I think they're the schools not to to attend anymore. But what we have is that we have an ability to awaken, okay? And to try to come out of this mesmerized, delusional state. And I want to thank you for listening tonight.